Hi, welcome to episode 359 of the Fantastic Forecast. I'm David Elliott, and I'm a member of a BDSM club. It's the Bob Dylan Surf Music Club. We get together and listen to the albums he released in his mid-60s beach music phase. There's The Tides, They Are A-Changin', The Surfin' Side of Bob Dylan, and Riding the Waves Back Home. Today, Fantastic Four, 359 from December 1991, Devos, The Devastator, by Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan. So we pick up where we left off last issue. The Fantastic Four spaceship is damaged, and they're stuck out in the middle of deep space. Reed is hard at work trying to fix it. Johnny's busy welding parts together. Sue is busy thinking to herself, "Did I leave the iron on?" No, not really. I don't know what she's doing. Reed comes out and tells everyone that he's fixed the jet boosters, but they still need to fix the hyperdrive system. He says maybe they can jury-rig a new system, but it could take months or even years. Yes, they wouldn't be able to get back to Earth for years. They could cancel this book and retitle it Fantastic Four Voyager, which doesn't sound very appealing at all. Reed asks Sue to take an inventory of their food and air reserves, while Johnny seems distracted by events over in the cockpit of the ship. Ben is sitting there at the controls, while Alicia, gotta get used to calling her Alicia again, Alicia is starting to nag him, saying, Ben, you can't keep avoiding me. She says that Johnny told her about the Skrull that was posing as her, and she wants to talk about it. Ben says there's no time to talk. Something has popped up on their scanners. Something really big. And over on that big ship, a man in a bulky dark blue suit of armor is hunting these weird alien flying creatures that have infested his ship. He calls them a potential hazard, and they must be exterminated. He says their entire species must be exterminated, hunted to extinction, by this man in armor who calls himself Devos the Devastator. So he shoots several of these creatures dead and leaves the robot cleaning crew to pick up after his mess. As he walks down the hall, he mentions how he's exterminated countless other races. This guy's a genocidal maniac. And on the wall, we see some of his trophies, the heads of some of the aliens he's killed. There's a Skrull, there's an alien from the Infant Terribles race, an alien similar to Zimnu the Titan. I sure hope it's not Zimnu the Titan. That would be a terrible loss. I think he's even got a predator on the wall. We learn that there's one adversary that has eluded him all these years, but one of these days, oh yes, one of these days, he will discover a way to destroy his adversary's entire race. We don't really find out any more about that. But first, an alarm goes off, another ship is in the area, Devos goes to check it out, and back with the FF, Reed sees his big ship outside and he's like, "Oh goody, they may have the technology to return us to Earth." Ben suggests, maybe they ain't big on sharing. Sharing? I thought Sharon left this book. Oh, I think he meant they're not big on sharing. I'm guessing Devos the Devastator isn't likely to give them a friendly tow to the nearest spaceship repair shop. What does happen is the FF's ship gets snagged by a tractor beam and pulled into the bigger ship, and a passenger ramp extends over the doorway. The five of them head down the ramp, they get probed by a bunch of bright lights, and they head into the hangar. And Devos is watching them on a monitor. These holes open up in the floor, and everyone falls down into the cells below. With Sue, she expands one of her force fields and cracks open the cell and finds that Reed, Johnny, and Ben also have broken free. It took them all of 10 seconds. Record time. The only problem is, they don't know where Alicia is. But then on the next panel, on the next page, they find Alicia's cell, and they help her free. They look around and see a huge range of other aliens also being held captive. Ben says it's kind of like the Bronx Zoo, only in outer space. Actually, it's kind of like the wide variety of homeless men locked in my ba- Oops, I forget I said that. You didn't hear that. This big robot comes into the room, and Ben figures it must be the zookeeper, and he tackles it, knocking it over, but in the process, the robot smashes a bunch of other cages with his hands, releasing a bunch of very creepy critters into the room, giving the FF something to fight for a few pages. Devos is still watching, and he starts to think these humans are the greatest threat of all. They're smart and powerful. And Devos doesn't like smart and powerful. He likes them dumb and weak. just the way I like my homeless men. Oh, wait, shit. I didn't mean to mention that again. Forget it. Alicia is kind of freaking out. She doesn't know what is going on, and it's a good thing she can't see. She would really freak out at the sight of the three hideous creatures sneaking up behind her. But Johnny swoops in just in time and drives the creatures back with his flames. Alicia's first question is, "Where's Ben? Is he all right?" Johnny, meanwhile, is having a hard time getting used to the fact that he's not married to Alicia and never was. His wife was a Skrull, and he thinks that she's dead now. Back over with the thing, it's clobbering time as he takes a swing and shatters the huge zookeeper robot with a powerful punch. Reed tells everyone to get ready. They got bigger problems. Devos the Devastator shows up in person. And what does he try to do? Oh, what do you think he does? He tries to devastate the Fantastic Four with a big laser blast. He tells them he is Devos, the Supreme Protector of the Galactic Peace. I have a feeling he gave himself that title. So as you can imagine, a fight breaks out between Devos and the Fantastic Four. He's kind of caught off guard by the FF's powers, but he always seems to have something to counter their powers. A foam to extinguish the Human Torch's flames, infrared goggles to look at the Invisible Woman. He has these electric shock powers that put the hurt on Mr. Fantastic, but he does have a hard time breaking through Sue's force fields. She pushes him down with one, and when he gets up, he ends up trading punches with the Thing. But then, he delivers a powerful electric shock to Ben, and Ben fights through it and tosses Devos to the ground. Devos runs away and closes the door behind him, locking the FF in the chamber. But it doesn't take long for Ben to smash through the wall, and they keep chasing after Devos. Devos reaches a power grid, and he starts trying to power up his armor. The Reed turns into a ball, and Ben tosses the Reed ball at Devos, who lets go of the handholds and falls back into the grid, which is a little too much power, and it damages his armor. Next, an alarm goes off, and Devos says that's the ship's self-destruct system. It was designed to avoid capture, and all this commotion set it off. Devos runs away, and the FF come face to face with the entire collection of alien creatures released from their cages. Devos gets in an escape shuttle and flies away. A gas comes out of the wall and kills all the alien creatures, and Sue protects the FF and Alicia with a force field. So they get to the bridge of the ship, and Reed figures how to turn off the gas and stop the self-destruct just in time, as Sue is exhausted and her force field gives out. So later, the robot maids arrive, and they come and clean up, and Reed has set the ship on a course to Earth. Sue says she feels bad for all those creatures that were killed. She calls it a waste. It is kind of a waste. They didn't get to eat any of them. I bet most of them tasted like chicken. Reed says it's better that they died. They might have had all kinds of extraterrestrial germs or diseases, and it's not like they could have turned them loose on Earth. And then the issue ends in a room with a large egg sitting on a pedestal, and the egg is cracked. Coming next time, the Fantastic Four versus Humpty Dumpty, an epic you won't want to miss. Or maybe it's the FF versus a character called Dreadface, which doesn't sound as exciting. So before this podcast ends, I've got other business to discuss. I still haven't gone over the FF annual from 1991 yet, so before we get to 1992, we better get on to that. Oh, those early 1990 annuals are the absolute worst. Welcome to Fantastic Forecast Episode 359, Part 2, Fantastic Four Annual 24 from 1991, The Korvac Quest Part 1, Future Tense, by Al Milgram, Cubed. Yes, Al Milgram to the third power. I guess that means he wrote it, penciled it, and inked it. And boy, that's way too much Al Milgram. Oh, and this issue guest stars the Guardians of the Galaxy. Of course, this ain't your father's Guardians of the Galaxy. It's your grandfather's Guardians of the Galaxy. No talking raccoons. No talking trees. This Guardians of the Galaxy bears even less resemblance to the movie version of the Guardians than the comic book Fantastic Four bears to the new upcoming movie version of the Fantastic Four. And that's saying a lot. The issue starts with a two-page recap of the origin of the FF, just in case this is someone's first issue of the Fantastic Four. I'm guessing for anyone whose first issue of the Fantastic Four was this, it was also probably the last. So the main story begins in the recent past. We learn a little about a guy named Michael Korvac, a man from the 31st century who had been turned into a living computer by the alien race, the Badoon, and his lust for power had been crushed by the Guardians of the Galaxy, and we see that Korvac had ended up on the large spaceship belonging to Galactus, and he absorbed a bunch of the knowledge of the ship and became a godlike being. And he ended up in a fight with the Avengers and the Guardians of the Galaxy, and all this caught the attention of Galactus, who picked up his ultimate nullifier and fired, hoping to ultimately nullify Korvac. All of this also caught the attention of the Time Variance Authority. I'm guessing this was not mentioned in the original Avengers Korvac saga. The TVA agents are not too keen on Galactus firing off his ultimate nullifier, meaning it will be a lot more work for them, correcting and erasing timelines and such. Lots of extra overtime. They're complaining that Galactus uses it too much! But doesn't the ultimate nullifier destroy the entire universe? I was under the impression that Galactus had never used it and never would. But obviously Al Milgram isn't under the same impression regarding the ultimate nullifier. Someone at the TVA says they should tell Galactus to stop using it, but an administrator says they have the authority to do that. But who's going to tell Galactus that? So they get ready for some massive overtime. Back with Korvac, he senses that the ray from the ultimate nullifier is coming, so he kills himself before it gets there, and this little ball of energy containing all of Korvac's knowledge and power shoots out of his head, and is supposed to return to Korvac back in the 31st century, where he's born. Back at the TVA, the agents are quite happy to see that Korvac has killed himself. It'll save a lot of hassle. I haven't seen people so happy over a suicide since that guy who wrote the song You Light Up My Life put a plastic bag over his head. So that ends this little prologue and catches us up back to wherever we find the Guardians of the Galaxy. Their individual names are not important, because I don't know them, and they're fighting with members of an alien race, the Badoon. In the middle of the fight, the one guy they call Starhawk suddenly collapses. He says he just sensed a conflict with Michael Korvac, and the universe as they know it is in grave danger. I like the way he calls it the universe as they know it. Why don't I just say the universe is in grave danger? But no, the universe, as we know it, is in grave danger. The female member of the Guardian says that Korvac is dead, isn't he? Another guy says that maybe Korvac still lives, so they need to travel back to the 20th century to the point where Korvac supposedly died. So the Guardians head back to their large space station headquarters known as Dry Dock, and they enter a time warp. And they sense the timeline where Galactus was about to eat the entire universe, but the Fantastic Four stopped them. Back in FF-341, so the Guardians decide to seek the help of this Fantastic Four. The Guardians head down to Earth, but they leave Vance Astro behind, as he's the only existing member of the team on Earth at this time. They arrive in the lobby of the Fantastic Four headquarters, and they contact Roberta the Robot, who leads them up to FF headquarters. They arrive to find the entire FF hard at work, helping Reed on one of his projects. Starhawk of the Guardians tells Reed about how they're trying to find this Michael Korvac guy, and Reed mentions that he read about it in the Avengers files. He tells Ben to follow him down to his lab, I guess one of his labs, another lab, to retrieve some equipment he believes might help with this Korvac quest. I guess this story is appropriately named. They gather all this stuff together, and Reed starts to work on it. The Guardians tell Reed that Korvac might strike somewhere in a matter of days. Reed says, "In that case, we'll want to locate Dr. Hank Pym. I'll need some of his help with this." What? Reed needs the help of Hank Pym? Oh, surely that's a mistake. So anyway, 3 days later, yes, 3 days later, I've seen Reed put entire spaceships together in less time than that, he and Hank Pym have adapted a sub-phonetic spectro-analyzer to search for Galactus' energy. That's the source of Korvac's power, which seems like one of the simplest devices Reed has ever devised, and he needed Hank Pym's help for that? Reed's also cooked up a very large device called the Self-Contained Time Redundancy Probability Field Projector for Vance Astro to use, and they have Hank Pym shrink it so Vance Astro can wear it on his wrist. Now, why oh why didn't Reed just make it that small in the first place? Whatever this device is, it allows Vance to participate in this adventure, even though another version of himself is also on Earth at this time. Next, they tell Hank Pym they don't need his help anymore, and to scram, telling him to contact other superheroes if the Fantastic Four and the Guardians of the Galaxy fail. I guess since this story crosses over into three other annuals, Hank Pym might actually have to do that. So they turn on the Korvac tracer, and they try to get an energy reading from Korvac. They beam up to the Guardian space station and beam down to Australia, where they find Gateway, the aboriginal teleporter who worked with the X-Men back then. They scan him, but no, he's not Korvac. But soon they find some lady walking around the outback by herself, and they scan her, and it seems that she's Korvac. The woman, her name is Jeboa Murphy, seems a little dazed and confused. She walks across a large puddle, right on top of the water. She sees the combined forces of the Fantastic Four and the Guardians of the Galaxy on their way over to beat the shit out of her, and she's like, no! She zaps them with cosmic power, and Reed wraps his body around her and says he thinks she's connected to a man called Korvac. She replies, Korvac? Yes! And we learn that Korvac's power and knowledge was transferred over to Jeboa, and she zaps everyone again with her powers, and they all go flying. They fight for a few pages, but soon Jeboa, I'll call her the She-Korvac, has everyone except Reed defeated. On the ground, unconscious, and maybe they're all dead. Reed pulls out a time machine. He pulls out a time machine miniaturized by Hank Pym. He uses the time machine to travel a short time back into the past, risking the wrath of the TVA again, no doubt. Reed goes back to Gateway and tells him he needs his help. Reed travels in time again, and with Gateway's help, over to Queens, New York, to the site of the battle where Korvac was almost zapped by the ultimate nullifier. In a bit of incredible, far-fetched craziness, Reed holds the time machine out in front of the ultimate nullifier rays, and he travels back to the present and back to Australia, and he aims the time machine at the She-Korvac, and the rays shoot out of the time machine right toward the She-Korvac, but just like Korvac did before, she sends her powers and knowledge off to someplace else, and someone else, and the ultimate nullifier beam comes to a stop before it hits the now innocent girl, who is no longer the She-Korvac. For a moment, the Guardians debate whether or not they should kill Jeboa anyway, just in case. But they decide not to. Jeboa gets up and waves goodbye, and gets the hell out of there before anyone changes their mind. Of course, she's in the middle of the Australian outback, so she'll probably be dead in a week or so anyway. The Guardians say they need to travel in time again, and find where Korvac's powers went to this time. Reed hands them the scanning device, and the Guardians teleport away. Next, the Fantastic Four are about to ask Gateway to send them home, when this faceless bureaucrat from the TVA shows up, demanding to have Reed's little time machine. Reed says he's heard of the TVA, and thought he might hear from them. And we learn the story takes place before FF-350. So they don't put up a fight. Reed hands the time machine over to the TVA agent, and Gateway teleports the FF home. And that is the end of the story. It seems like the so-called Korvac quest continues elsewhere, but oddly enough, it doesn't say where. It sounds like this ends the FF's involvement in the story, so we'll just forget parts 2, 3, and 4. Thanks to Google, it continues in Guardians of the Galaxy Annual 1, Silver Surfer Annual 4, Thor Annual 16, none of which I own or want to own. So since this is the early 90s and this is one of those 64-page annuals, we have backup stories. Bad backup stories. And once again, she's back. Volcana. In a story called Ashes to Ashes by James Brock, writer and penciler. James Brock. Legendary James Brock. The story begins at a space station in orbit around Earth. They detect some kind of energy beam originating from deep space, hitting Earth right over Denver, Colorado. They scan the energy beam and determine that the energy is similar to that of the Cosmic Cube. I don't know what it is about the Volcana and the Cosmic Cube, but the powers that be at Marvel back then loved to do backup stories in the FF annuals about them both. The guy in charge of the space station orders a search team to head down to Denver and look for clues regarding the beam's purpose and destination, and concludes, an opportunity, however slight, to find or reproduce the Cosmic Cube can only be in the best interest of AIM, Advanced Idea Mechanics, not AOL Instant Messenger. So 3 weeks later, down in Denver, Marcia, aka Volcana, is heading back to her apartment for the first time in a long time, the one she used to share with Molecule Man. She opens the door, And what does she find inside? It's Molecule Man. She rushes to hug him, and he's like, "Hi, Marcia." He was merged with the Cosmic Cube, and she asked him how he escaped. He explains that it just kind of happened, and he was the energy beam that hit Denver 3 weeks earlier. She asked why he didn't call her sooner, and he replies that he didn't want to intrude on her new life. Outside their window, the agents of AIM have arrived, and they're eavesdropping and spying on the two former lovers. They better hope that if Volcana and Molecule Man start having sex, the AIM ship comes equipped with barf bags. Suddenly, there's a loud noise. The wall explodes apart. A pink beam of light enters the room and assembles itself as Claw, Master of Sound. Molecule Man seems injured in the blast, and Volcana threatens Claw, and Claw grabs her and tosses her out the hole in the wall. Unfortunately, she now has that power where she can turn herself into rock, and she lands in the back of some dude's pickup truck unharmed. Claw tries to leave the building holding Molecule Man's unconscious body, and Volcana starts throwing stuff at him, tires and broken parts from the pickup truck. With his powers, Claw creates his big pink robot for Volcana to fight, while the agents of AIM just hang back and watch, amazed that Volcana has turned into some kind of volcanic rock creature. The robot had a giant axe, but it drops it, and Volcana picks up the axe. She struggles to swing it, but she hits the pink robot with it, and the robot disappears. Claw comes down and zaps Volcana in the back. He creates this squid-like creature that attaches itself to Volcana's body. It wraps around her neck and starts to choke her, as we'd all like to do. And she passes out. Claw is about to put her out of her misery, and put us out of our misery, but the agents of AIM show up and tell Claw that they may have a use for her. Claw thinks back to how recently AIM saved his life and healed him when he was injured, so he listens and spares Volcana's life. But she starts to wake up, and she uses her powers to turn into volcanic ash. Ooh, how scary. She's turned into ash. Who'd want to fight a big cloud of ash? I'm being sarcastic, of course. So Volcana and Claw start fighting again, and she gets knocked into the ground and she starts glowing. Molecule Man is powerless, so all he can do is watch. AIM detects that she's emitting some kind of cosmic cube type energy, and this energy affects Molecule Man. And now, he has his powers back, and he creates this vacuum tank to surround Claw, which keeps him locked up for a bit. We learn that before he merged with the Cosmic Cube, he left some of his powers with Volcana, and that's what she used to give him his powers back. Claw starts breaking out of that metal tank, and the three of them start fighting again. During the fight, Claw hits Molecule Man with a sonic blast, seemingly killing him, and then he turns and grabs Volcana and blasts her into pieces. Thinking that his work is done, the two lamest of lame-o characters are dead. Claw turns and walks away, proclaiming that he's a free agent, no longer beholden to AIM. But after he's gone, Molecule Man wakes up, and Volcana pulls herself back together, but she passes out from the strain. Later, she wakes up back in their apartment. He tells her that he didn't contact her for 3 weeks because without his powers, he felt worthless. But now that he's got his powers back, he's got himself a little Molecule Man outfit as well. He's ready to have some fun. But surprisingly, when Volcana's mother and some of her friends come and knock on the door, she tells Molecule Man to leave. Everyone thinks that he's dead, and she needs to think over their relationship. So he flies away, and she's crying. And, oh, this is just about the most nauseating love story in the history of comics. And that is the end of this backup story. A whopping 20-page backup story. What the fuck? They devoted 20 pages to this? Can you believe it? Well, next up, it's backup story number 2, starring the Super Scroll, A Matter of Honor, by Lynn Kaminsky and Chris Ivey. The story begins with the Super Scroll flying through the air over a crowd of other Scrolls, who seem to be cheering for him. They're chanting, Kalert, 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 which I guess is his name. He lands on the stage beside the Scroll Empress, and he does a little, Warriors of the Scroll Race, I salute you, to pump up the crowd. Later, he's alone with the Scroll Empress. Oh, yeah. She says that he seems subdued. Maybe he gets subdued when he's ready to get it on. She asks, Are you not satisfied with the adoration of our people? I'm not sure why the Skrulls love him. He's constantly getting his ass kicked back on Earth by the likes of the Fantastic Four, Thor, Iron Fist, Miss Marvel, Moon Knight? Maybe not Moon Knight, I don't know. Super Skrull says, I do not deserve their tribute, my Empress. Okay, maybe he has gotten his ass kicked by Moon Knight. That would ruin anyone's self-esteem. We learn that during an encounter with a Captain Reptile, this was a character that looks like, you can figure it out. They trick Reptile into thinking that he killed the Super Skrull, and Super Skrull's not too happy with this. Doesn't like it at all. But the Empress orders the Super Skrull to keep this business with Captain Reptile a secret. He says that he obeys, but I guess this was a boner killer, so he turns and he leaves. Later, at the temple of the Skrull war god, Sluggert, the Super Skrull is there bowing down before this huge statue, which is, I guess, the war god Sluggert, and he's saying to his war god, Sluggert, that he feels disgraced, and he's torn about whether or not to obey the Skrull Empress. So he decides, fuck her, he's going to clear his name. Later, Captain Reptile and his crew are flying through space on their ship when the Super Skrull drops by for a visit. Reptile is surprised. He thought he killed this guy. But he orders, charge off, Faither Banks. And they fire at the Super Skrull, who has the powers of all the members of the Fantastic Four. And he blocks the lasers with a force field. He fires back at the ship with some flames. He damages the ship, breaches the hull, and the Super Skrull flies in. Captain Reptile says, I killed you. And the Skrull replies, I'm here to return the favor. He grabs Captain Reptile, and he flies back into the vacuum of space, where Captain Reptile can't breathe. And he suffocates, and dies, thus restoring the Super Skrull's low self-esteem. But later, he has to face the Skrull Empress with this transgression. He says that he's prepared to face execution. She's like, don't tell me what the punishment's gonna be. I and I alone will decide that. Instead of having him killed, she strips him of his rank and orders him to serve Commander Katarg of the Imperial Fleet until she deems him worthy of other duties. She orders him to leave, so he flies out. The crowds below see him in the air, and they cheer him again. End of story, and the end of this annual, thank goodness, and the end of another year of Fantastic Four adventures. Coming next time, FF360 from January 1992. You can download other episodes to iTunes or find them all at www.podcastff.podbean.com. And if you have any questions about the Fantastic Four, about this podcast, or if you need relationship advice, you can email me at podcastff@gmail.com. So long, kids. This podcast is over.